broadcasting for reasons still unclear. This is the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.
I guess we should start with Tiger just because it's the most recent, and frankly, I don't think there was a great deal of revelation that comes out of what happened. He was not asked for a laundry list of his hookups. That's not going to happen. There's a comfort level with the people.
What's your move? Like, yeah. How are you so successful?
Yeah, what's your go-to?
Yeah.
I have $1 billion and a yacht. Here's the sell. It didn't get into that. There were questions about the doctor. And what the most interesting thing to me, not what was said, but just Tiger's, his body language and the fact that when he sat down, his eyes darted around that room and never stopped while he was giving his opening statement. And it was almost disorienting to me. I'm like thinking, look at this guy's eyes. He was just looking for an unfamiliar face in a sea. And I don't know if he saw one, but he was never asked a question that would have put him totally off balance. But he took all of it on himself. I did it. He says he's trying to work through it. The reaction that he got from the patrons at Augusta National, he said, was overwhelmingly positive. And now, I guess, go play golf. And frankly, I think that's how we devour scandal. Scandal, scandal, scandal. Oh, you're going to go back and play golf? Okay, fine. It's not like people aren't going to watch. And anyone that says they aren't are lying.
He was very enthusiastic about his return to golf, being like, I can't wait for that first tee. And people asked about, well, you were able to win and you were successful despite all these personal problems you were going through. So do you really feel like it was that much of a detriment? And he's like, look, I wasn't really enjoying it. Think about the stuff I was caught up in. And I think that's kind of an honest answer. He's like, here I'm dealing with this kind of double life, and I'm letting my family down, but they don't know, and it's not public, and I'm winning tournaments. And his sense today was like, I'm actually going to get back out there, though, and just play. And he sounded like he was happier. Now, they touch on all sorts of topics. As you mentioned, the doctor, why would you bring in a doctor who's been busted for things, and you brought him into your state 4 times, not even from the country. He said there were specific things that he had done and with athletes that made him comfortable with him. He also was asked about Steve Williams, his caddy, and his management team. Are these guys going to return? And he was like, look, I've had great conversations with them. A lot of them didn't know what was going on. I don't necessarily believe that his caddy never knew anything, going back to his caddy's interview, but you get the sense that he's on board. He's going to be his caddy for a long time, and that's not going to be an issue. He was actually asked if Elin would be at the Masters with the family this week, and he said no. And they were like, well, don't you think maybe she should be here? And he put it to bed rather quickly. But there wasn't that real exciting soundbite of the 36 minutes that he spent talking to this group. And there was a ton of people in there.
There
will be that reaction, predictably. And really, no matter what he had said today, where there's going to be people that are very disappointed that people didn't ask tougher questions, or at least
that'll be
just not let up and want that kind of seediness that seems to excite the tabloids, which I just didn't think was going to happen today in this setting.
No, there was no way it was going to happen in that setting, and perhaps there'll be accurate points made about the fact that there is a familiarity in the room of many of the people. Tiger described many as friends. People would say that about me and Tiger. I've known him for 15 years, and I always describe it the same way. We have a professionally friendly relationship. It's not like he's going to call me up while I'm headed to Augusta after the show. We're not going to dinner. We never have. That's not the relationship that there is. But if the familiarity didn't allow people to unleash the TMZ torrent of questions, that just wasn't going to happen.
Donating our time to improve your sports knowledge.
What? Yeah, BFF.
Man, just pound it out.
Give me some of that. Man, that was not really...
Yeah. Can we do that over?
It's too late.
You're listening to the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.
I'm headed to Augusta as soon as this show is over for our Masters coverage. First and second round coverage here on ESPN Thursday and Friday. We get the par 3 contest Wednesday, and Andy North and I'll have a hour-long show for you, 5 Eastern, on Wednesday. And right now we get down to Augusta, Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Andy North joins us. And Andy, I'm not going to ask you to grade how Tiger's press conference went, because it's not your job to tell me that. What you can tell me is what was the mood like there this morning when he was out with Fred Couples. Tiger talked about how the patrons embraced him. What was your sense of his return there today?
Well, Scotty, I thought it was really interesting that early on it was a little quiet, and then I think people kind of warmed up, and he spent the day out there, and it got better and better and better.
Do you think that will continue to be the overall theme of the week, that people, especially there, it's a different type of place, as you and I know well, but do you think that will be the overriding theme among the people to Tiger, is welcome back, as opposed to, hey, why'd you screw up?
I think so. I think this is the one venue, and maybe the British Open is also where the fans are such great golf fans. They're here for a reason. That's to watch the best players in the world play. And they have missed him playing. And I think that's the case with not only the patrons here, but I think also a lot of the other players are so happy to have him back and just, you know, get him back doing what we love to watch him do.
Andy North, one of our golf analysts at ESPN, joining us, Scott Van Pelt Show, Ryan Russillo on ESPN Radio. Tiger talked about that anticipation of the first tee on Thursday, and he spoke with this enthusiasm that surprised me a little bit. What did you think of his talk of how excited he is about his return?
Well, I think if you take a step back and look at what he said about, he really felt like he'd lost the love of the game. And I think that happens to everybody out here when you're other places with your mind. And I think, if he's actually gotten that feel back and that joy of competing back, you look forward to playing, teeing it up on Thursday. Yeah, he'll be nervous. I mean, every single one of us is nervous when you tee it up the first hole. If you're not, there's something wrong with you. But I think it'll be really, really interesting to see how he handles himself on the golf course. And he says that he's going to be changed out there. He's going to be better. We'll have to see.
He did touch on that and his talk of he doesn't want to have as many negative outbursts. But he also said he doesn't want to be so exuberant on big shots, on winning shots. Is that the right thing if you're talking about one of the best competitors going?
Well, you can be competitive and not have to run across the green fist pumping on every single shot. You know, he is the secret of playing our game, as most of the great players have been for years, is keeping that sort of calmness when good things go well and when bad things go poorly. And I think that's something that it'll be interesting to see if he can do. I mean, trust me, he's such a competitor. He gets out there, he does something great, he'll be celebrating. I mean, that's just part of his nature. But maybe it won't be as much. Maybe it won't be, you know, the unbelievable quick reactions to poor shots. So, you know, looking forward to it. I hope he's got it figured out, as most people.
Last thought for you, Andy. Was there anything specifically that he said, a wow moment for you, or an answer that you thought was particularly revealing or interesting?
Well, I think, you know, he said the phrase before, but taking a step back and having to really look at yourself, That's not an easy thing to do when you've been a mess. And I think then later on, talking about missing his son's first birthday, I thought he got close to being emotional right there, and I think he saw a side of Tiger that maybe, you know, we haven't seen much over the last 4 or 5 years. But overall, I thought he was very sincere. Curtis and I sat there watching it together, and I was looking at his eyes, and generally you can kind of tell deep into a person looking into his eyes, and I thought he was very, very sincere at that point.
Andy, look forward to seeing you late this evening. I assume I have the upstairs bedroom as usual.
You have the children's room and in the attic, And don't wake anybody when you come in.
I won't. I'm going to come jump up and down in your bed, and we'll do what we normally do and hoot and holler until the wee hours. Look forward to seeing you, pal.
It'll be fun to have you here, Scotty.
All right, man.
See you guys.
We'll see you.
The Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio. It's your show as much as ours. Get involved at svp@espnradio.com.
Redskins tight end Chris Cooley joins us now. And Chris, what's the reaction when you hear that a guy you've had to battle against is now going to wear your colors?
Hey, man. I was shocked they let him go. I couldn't believe Philly was going to let the guy go, even though I heard about it a couple weeks ago. I know that there's a lot going on with some money and everything there, but God, he's done so much for that team. It was amazing to let him go, but I'm excited. I think it's good for us. You know, I mean, as far as the Redskins go, we've switched quarterbacks so much over the last 15 years, and at least you're getting a guy that's a proven guy.
You're no dummy. I'm sure you know that Celek, the tight end, caught 76 last year. Just personally, you don't want to be greedy, but I mean, it's nice to know that the guy looks for your position, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Celek and McNabb had a great relationship the last couple years. I watched a lot of Eagles film offensively because obviously we play every team they play, and it's awesome to watch the way McNabb gives him a chance to go get the ball. And all his receivers. You'll see Celek covered, running routes that look like he'd never get it, and McNabb trusts him and will throw him the ball. So hopefully I can build that relationship quickly and get on a good note with Donovan and maybe catch more than 74.
Chris Cooley is the tight end of the Washington Redskins, talking about his new teammate, Donovan McNabb, here on the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio. What were your first thoughts about your quarterback the last couple of years, Jason Campbell?
Well, that was one of the first things that my family and I talked about, was Jason was such a good guy. And he was a great teammate. And still, I mean, he is a great teammate, obviously. I thought he died. I feel bad for him. He's been through a lot with the team and with the Redskins. I feel bad for what he's had to go through. Obviously, I feel like he's a starting quarterback, and we'll see what happens here in the next couple months with him and if he's with us or what happens. But I just hope it works out good for him, man.
I'm sure you and some of your friends that you're close with on the team, you have a feeling about this upcoming season. Like, you've talked about it, you've been out to dinner, however you guys hang out. What does this do to change the talk about the anticipation? You know what I'm saying? But, like, you know, however you guys talk about now, how does that change? Like, what does something like this do to change that conversation? Like, are you fired up to, like, hang out with these guys again to just sit there and talk about McNabb and the possibilities?
I think it's a great opportunity for everyone. I think it's not just the idea that we bring in Donovan McNabb and we're going to be better. I mean, there's been a complete overhaul of the Washington Redskins organization, right? And
that had to happen, didn't it?
At the point we were at, yeah, it did. It just we weren't in a great situation, so I think it was good for us. But from the minute Mike's came in and the moves they've made and the things Bruce has done, that's when you started to feel that this is a completely different situation. It's just been so business at our facility. From our meetings to the guys that we've released to the guys that we've picked up, it's been business. And to me, I've liked everything that they've done. In my mind, if I was playing GM, I've liked everything that they've done. I would have done that. So I'm excited about about the direction that we're going in and how they've went about it.
Well, I'm sure that the reaction in D.C., a football-crazed town, has got to be one of optimism that we haven't seen in a few years, so that's exciting to hear about. Chris, appreciate your time, your perspective. As always, hope the offseason is going well, and we'll look forward to talking to you somewhere down the road.
Yeah, sounds good, guys. Thank you.
From the worldwide leader in sports.
About that time, y'all.
This is the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.
Jay Billis, who joins Ryan Russillo and me, Scott Van Pelt, here on ESPN Radio. And J.B., look, I get the Hinkle Fieldhouse. No one loves Hoosiers in the picket fence more than me, but I feel like all these comparisons to that film diminish who Butler is. Do you feel the same way?
I do. I feel a lot of the talk, Scotty, that we have about mid-majors and about college basketball diminishes it and diminishes these teams and what they've accomplished, and especially a team like Butler. I mean, you know, the coaches around the country aren't idiots. You know, Shelvin Mack and Gordon Hayward were picked for the U.S. national team after their freshman years in college. And the idea that, well, mid-majors, the way they win is they get seniors, you know, guys that play together. That does happen, and it happens a lot. But this is a team full of sophomores. Their best players are sophomores. And a couple of their role players are seniors. But, you know, the top three players on this team are two sophomores, a junior, and then their best defender is a sophomore, Ronald Norred. So they're not the typical mid-major, and they've been good for a long time. You know, Butler didn't just come out of nowhere to be successful. They've been successful over time with good coaches and good players. So it is kind of insulting, but it fits our narrative. And,
of course.
And, you know, most of the guys, you've been in the press room a million times. They're all running around going, this is a great story. And that's what this winds up being, is a great story rather than acknowledging we've got a really, really good basketball team here.
We understand that there's a head injury with Howard, but I mean, you don't know what's in a young man's head or his heart, and you don't mess around with this, but you'd have to believe that barring something crazy, he'll give it a shot tonight, correct?
I think he's playing. You know, I think they're doing all the right things and saying all the right things about you don't mess around with concussions. And,
for sure.
And that's exactly what they should be doing, but my sense is he's going to play, and I think they have to prepare. I think Duke has to prepare for him to play, which, you know, my experience with Coach K, anytime there was talk about an injury with the other team, his thing was, look, this guy's playing, and we need to prepare for him playing. So don't fall into the trap of thinking they're going to be anything less with him or without him, because they're not.
Jay Billis helping us with the championship game tonight, Duke and Butler, here on the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio. What do you do with Duke when they make threes off of misses on offensive rebounds?
Well, I mean, that's something that, that they've done a really good job of over the years. And I've always believed, and I think I got it from the guy I played for and coached under, Coach K, that the best time to shoot a three is after an offensive rebound. And, you know, you're not, as a defender, you're not thinking about playing defense again when a shot goes up. You're thinking about getting the ball and going the other way. And guards hardly ever block out. If you can find me a guard that blocks out, you know, we'll give them some kind of award because they never do it. And what winds up happening is they think they're really rebounding when they go in and they stick their nose in there in the lane. And, you know, they may get a little bit of a long rebound, or if you bring the ball down, they strip it, something like that. But I think when you play against Duke, you have to stay with your assignment and make contact with them and box him out. And if the ball's coming your way, then go get it. But if it's not, you have to stay with that guy and make certain that that he's not getting a step in three. But, you know, one of the things that does is it makes it a little bit easier for guys like Zubek and Thomas to get offensive rebounds. But at least then you're only giving up two. You're not giving up a three.
How hard is it if you were to say to a team, now you have to do something tonight that's different than anything you've done before, and say specifically in this, and I'm not saying like this is the key to the game, but say, okay, all of a sudden now, guys, if you're Brad Stevens, the Butler's coach, you have to make sure you're constantly staying with guards instead of trying to help inside or leak out on the offense. Can you make a dramatic change like that in one game when it's kind of different from what your instincts have told you to do throughout the regular season?
That's a good question. I think with help side, when you're trying to change your help rules, it's really hard.
Right.
In other words, if you have a team that's got great shooters and you usually would help on a drive, instinctively you're probably going to do that because you've been drilled to do it, and under stress you're probably going to continue to do it. But I think something like blocking out, which you have an emphasis, and Butler does not, they're not a team that leaks out, you know, tends to leak out early. They stay and finish their defensive possession, and they do stick with their guys, and they're really smart. They've got smart players that can make adjustments. So I don't think making that adjustment is that big of a deal. But the other side of that, Ryan, is you don't want to overdo it and say, listen, don't leave, you know, don't ever leave John Shire, because, you know, you might take yourself out of making some other plays that you would normally make if you get too wrapped up in the idea of keeping them from getting, you know, three offensive rebounds that turn into threes. Those are big plays. But you don't want to make a strength of theirs into a big weakness of yours by overcompensating.
Jay Billis joining us from Indianapolis. It's the championship game tonight, Duke and Butler. Scott Van Pelt show with Ryan Russillo on ESPN Radio. And Jay, you have said since the final was set that you felt that Duke was the better team and that they were likely to win. If Duke plays anything approaching the level they had the other night against West Virginia, which was magnificent, Nolan Smith really playing his best basketball of the year, would it take a remarkable effort from Butler in order to pull off this upset?
Yes. If Duke shoots 53% and knocks down 13 threes, Duke will win. I don't think there's any question about that. I think that Butler is due for a good shooting game. I just think Duke has too many weapons on the offensive end that are going to be so hard to contain.
What can you tell us about the different stages of Brian Zubek's career at Duke?
I think he's a great advertisement for sticking with it. You know, the kid really stuck with it. And, you know, middle of the season, what is it, 20 games in, he starts against Maryland, pulls down 17 rebounds. I mean, that's, you know, great players don't pull down 17 rebounds in a game. Duke has had some great players, and they've not pulled down 17 rebounds. And he pulls down 17, 16. He's averaging 10 in the tournament. And he's playing to his strengths. He's kept it simple. He's not trying to overdo things in the post. He's a good passer and always has been. And he's finishing plays. And he's become a vital part of their success. Without him, they're not here. And middle of the season, if you would have told me Duke's going to win this whole thing, I would have said, well, they're going to have a lot of luck. You know, lots going to have to go their way. Well, the luck was 7'1", number 55. I mean, that was his development got them here, and without it, they wouldn't be here.
I want to close with just a thought on Mike Krzyzewski, Jay. You mentioned you played for him, you coached under him, you know him very, very well. He's done everything there is to do in this game. If he were to win this title, you know how the discussion goes in the world we live in. Is he the best coach ever? I'm not asking that question. I just want to know, for the man, what would this mean for him?
I think it would be great for him. You know, he's won three, he's won an Olympic gold medal, he's done so many things, and, you know, this is 11th Final Four. I mean, you can't even count all this stuff anymore. And in the press guide, it almost gets monotonous, there's so much of it, when most would kill just for one page of what he's done.
Right.
But I think it would mean a lot because of the players he's got now. Like what these guys have accomplished and how much fun he's had, and both coaches have said, and I think it's true, that their teams have gained more energy toward the end of the season when usually teams are wearing out. And I think both teams have energized their coaches. And I think Coach K is in a better place now than he's ever been as a coach. And I think the players have done that more so than anything.
Is $15 million a year in Jersey a better place next year?
He's not going to do that. I'm confident that he won't, but boy, that's a big pile of money. And I'd think about it if I were him, but he's not. I just can't see him doing that. He makes so much money now. So money, he's not going to do anything based on money. But I think he realizes, like, his legacy as a coach is tied up with Duke and college basketball, and he's gotten his NBA stuff through the Olympics and the success he's had there. And if he did that, I think he would look at things differently. People would look at him differently, even though they probably shouldn't. But I don't think he would. I just don't think he'll ever do that. Maybe I'm wrong, but $15 million would make me think about it. That's the one big pile of money that would make me do something I might not otherwise do.
Jay, the sad news is at the end of the night, there's no more college basketball for 7 months. We've appreciated your fantastic analysis and time. Coming soon to a golf course near you. Look for the big fella out there swinging the golf club. You've earned some time out there. Appreciate it, man. We'll look forward to seeing you soon.
Hey, always a pleasure being with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Connecting us to you. Twitter.com/SVP Show. SVP Show. You're in the middle of the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.
Can anybody beat Duke tonight? The only team that has a shot is Butler. You've heard the updates throughout the day. Looks like they'll have all hands on deck. And I come back to this. I know that everyone wants to hate on Duke because of the path that they face and the people that they won't face. I'm just doing some dips. Have no fear. It's not their fault.
It's not their fault that Kentucky lost to West Virginia,
the team that they just hammered. It's not their fault that Kansas couldn't get out of the first weekend and lost to Northern Iowa. All you can do is play the team in front of you. I'm tired of the Butler as Hoosiers because they play in Finkel Hill Fieldhouse, and they're the Cinderella. They haven't lost a game. They won 25 games in a row. I get that they're in the Horizon League. I get that Youngstown State on a Wednesday night in January is not a frightening road game, but this team plays suffocating defense. They've got a pro in Hayward, and I think that they've got a shot to compete tonight, but it just, absent that storyline, the whole Final Four just feels strange because all the teams we anticipated being there are not. Duke's playing their best basketball, and if Kay gets his fourth, that's a hell of an accomplishment and stamps him. I heard the discussion, is he the best coach of all time? The Final Four was different back in the day. John Wooden had to play 4 games to win a title.
Couldn't have another team from your region geographically being that. When I learned about that, going back and researching
stuff,
look.
They used to play New Mexico State, UCSB, and
Bama
in the Final Four.
We gave Bama a hard time for all their national titles.
Well, you know, that's a good point. We did crush Alabama for the botanist. The botanist that from New Orleans that said, I believe that Alabama is the national champions. Hence, they are.
11 years later.
Right. Well, UCLA has not fraudulent ones on there because at least they did have to win games. Point being, if Kay wins tonight, 4, that's remarkable. It's remarkable, and this team's playing its best basketball right now.
I'm just going to have a hard time. Well, you know what? Here's the point. Is each year is different,
yep.
And some years we have great championship teams, and other years we don't. And this year, no matter who won it, Duke included, you weren't going to finish this tournament and say to yourself, well, after the Final Four, I feel like this is the superior team. We get too caught up in that. We get too caught up in like thinking the New England Patriots, when they were 18-0, weren't that good. Like, well, you know, they lost. Oh, who do you think is the better team this season? The Giants all year or the Patriots?
Right.
Now, granted, that was the one game. They're the Super Bowl champs, and that's the way it should be and will be remembered. But I think it's a far too simple exercise to just think that just because you won the tournament, that's the overall best team. I still think there's probably 5 teams that are better than them. But you're right. They're not there, so you can't be unfair to Duke. I do think Butler has a chance tonight.
What do they have to do?
They're just going to have to constantly annoy Shire and Nolan Smith on the outside. They can't let them get free. And what I mean by that is Baylor would do some really stupid things in their zone where they would help on Zubek, a 7-foot guy who really can't shoot 15 feet away from the basket, and all Zubek has to do is turn back around and find a wide-open Shire to hit a 3. You can never be leaving Smith or Shire at the 3-point line. You just can't.
But
if you're Mac, if you're NORAD, you just can't do that.
I agree. But what Duke does better than anybody else that I've seen is that off a miss, when one of their bigs gets the ball, their guards float back to the 3, and someone is always wide open. And if you leave Smith or Singler or Shire wide open, and you continue to allow them to just hammer away from 3, unless they have a bad night shooting the ball, they're awfully tough to beat. They shot the hell out of it against West Virginia. Butler cannot, and I don't think I'm saying anything you don't know, they cannot afford to go you know, 30% from the floor and not make a basket for 11 minutes, or they'll get hammered tonight. I don't think that that Butler's going to get beat tonight the way some people do. I've gotten texts that say Duke's free money, just lay the number. I don't agree with that.
Seven and a half now? Is it eight?
Yeah, it's around there. I mean, it's the world likes Duke, and you know me, I tend to be a contrarian.
But how many people that are betting this tonight really have watched Butler this year?
Probably very few.
So that line, again, is based more on what the action is going to do tonight. And they have to set it at a big enough of a number where they think, well, if
Butler
if
was favored against Michigan State. I found it interesting that they were a prohibitive dog, and that tells you everything.
But if they put this out at 4.5, 5, they're going to get so much money on the Duke side of things.
Right, that's why the fact that it is higher than I anticipated it would be makes me wonder if you're looking for a winner, I wouldn't give one out. I think Duke wins the basketball game, and I have a hard time believing that Butler can continue their string of holding teams under 60 points. But once is an accident, twice is a trend. 5 games tells you that this is a team that knows how to play on that side of the ball. Everybody in the building that's not wearing a D for Duke is going to be rooting for them. And if they win, it'll be a magical story. I just don't want to hear that it's Hoosiers and that they're running the picket fence.
They were basically a top 10 preseason team.
Thank you. They're a Boise State in basketball. And it's hard to imagine Boise State can win a national title, but they'll get a chance next year because they're going to start ranked in the top 3. And if they win all their games, they might finally get a chance on the field to prove it. Butler's earned the right to be on this court with Duke. I just think I think it will take more than they've got to win.
Yeah, I think the Boise State comparison is great there because now Boise State has done it enough over the last decade for them to be accepted. And as much as we're quick to anoint, we're very slow to kind of figure out some of these other things. We're just not paying enough attention, and that's the way it works out. We haven't paid enough attention to Butler, despite their runs over the year, to take them seriously. And from this point on, if they keep Brad Stevens, and you know what, maybe if they don't, because they found a way to replace other good coaches and keep recruiting guys in that area that other big-time schools that we assume are going to get, Indiana, Notre Dame, can't get because Butler's able to hang on to them, then they'll remain a real team and somebody that we don't say this is a big surprise, because it isn't a surprise. It isn't. You know what I mean?
But I think if you're Butler and you're Stevens, you look at what happened to Licklider very carefully and you say, I'm in a pretty good place. I've made us a top 10 team. We can recruit, to your point, at a level where we can compete, and we've gotten to the Final Four. Just like if you're Boise or you're at TCU, you got to the BCS game. You don't have to go to a middle level conference job someplace else where it's a hell of a lot harder to make it to the BCS. You can stay where you are, and I think Stevens will do that at Butler.
He'll be offered when it's time. Better jobs than Iowa, though.
The Scott Van Pelt Show.
Hello, America. This is Ernie Collar from Squid Billy. When I think of Scott Van Pelt, I need to do me some hollering. Woo! Better turn up your radio, Bob.
Mike Socia, who joins us now. And, Mike, I've gotten a kick out of reading some of the previews that have poo-pooed your guys' chances. You've won 3 straight division titles. Some players have moved on. And I get the sense that you really don't care what anybody thinks about your club because you like him. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I like our club, Scott. I do, and it doesn't matter if people think we're the best thing since sliced bread or we're a fluke and or we're gonna tank. That has no bearing at all what we need to do. We have a good club. You have to go out in the field no matter what it looks like on paper, no matter what your team looks like on paper, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. You need to go out there and play baseball, and that's what we focus all spring on doing. I think the last 10 games we saw a lot of good things that come together. We have a good club. We have a club that's going to contend. And we're gonna play good baseball this summer.
I know that you did finish the spring strong. What are you looking for in that last week to 10 days as you ramp up towards the marathon that is the season? Are you looking for specific things that you're seeing out of pitchers or position players that give you that feeling that you just mentioned?
Yeah, I think all through spring training, you might lose a game on March 8th, and you might lose it, 10-8, but you feel good because certain things move forward. Towards the end of spring, there's obviously probably a little more emphasis on the final outcome of a game, but still, you might lose a game and feel good about some of the things you see. I think it's important to try to build that offensive chemistry during the last 8 or 10 games of spring training. Get your lineup in there. Make sure everybody feels comfortable who's hitting in front of them, how the groupings are working. Make sure there's a simple thing like the signs, which might differ from player to player, that they're comfortable in those groupings. So there's a lot of things you try to accomplish the last 8 days. I think we had a great last 8 days of our camp, and we're ready to go.
Angels manager Mike Socia joins us here. Scott Van Pelt Show, Ryan Russillo on ESPN Radio. John Lackey's been the leader of your rotation. He signs with Boston in the offseason. How do you replace not only a one in the sense of what he did on the mound, but as a guy that did lead your starting five?
Well, John left some big footprints here, no doubt. But I think if you look at our whole rotation, just the cumulative talent we have from you know, Jared Weaver and to Joe Saunders, Irvin Santana, Joel Pinheiro, who came in, and Scott Kazmir for a full season. I think those five guys are going to match up with any five guys in baseball. I think any one of those guys have the ability to step out and become a number one. Who it'll be, I don't know, but I'm pretty confident when it's all said and done, we're going to have some starters that are going to put up some big numbers for us this year. And I think that we'll absorb, the footprints John left. There's no doubt he was a big part of what we've done. He's a great pitcher and a terrific competitor. And he mentored some of the younger guys on our staff too, so I think his influence will still be here to some extent. But we're, just like Sean Figg is leaving some footprints. I think that the sum of our whole team is going to absorb some of those big guys that left.
Brandon Wood is a minor league guy I've been reading about for a really long time. Now has a chance to be an everyday guy at third base. What made him ready for this season?
Well, I think he was ready for the challenge probably, maybe a year and a half ago, but sometimes players on a team that's winning or achieving have to kind of wait their turn and see when their opportunity is going to come. Brandon's made a lot of progress in his game, and I think the last couple of years, when he thought he was ready, it really helped him to stay, maybe touch the major leagues, but stay back down in AAA and still, refine his game. He's a terrific defender. He's going to give us a gold glove caliber defense at third base. He's got lightning in his bat. I mean, depending on how he adjusts to major league pitching, hitting it every day, he certainly has the potential to hit anywhere from 25 to 30 home runs as his career progresses. It might not happen right now, but I think it will progress to that. And I don't want to put that kind of pressure on a kid to say, hey, you can hit 25, 30, go out and do it. He's ready for the opportunity, and I think that he turns the page much better now than he did a couple of years ago if he has a bad at bat. He's evolved into a more complete offensive player, and we're excited to give him his chance.
Mike Socia, Angels manager, our guest with Ryan Russillo. I'm Scott Van Pelt. It's ESPN Radio. Tonight, 7:05 local, 10:05 on the East Coast. It's the Angels and Twins. You can see it on ESPN2. And you've been there since 2000, but on opening night, the bunting is out, the red, white, and blue. There's a sense of just all that could be. Can you describe still all these many years of your life devoted to this game, what the feeling of an opening day or an opening night is like, Mike?
Well, it takes a little different, I think it takes a little different perspective when you're a coach or a manager as opposed to being a player. As a player, it's everything you're leading up to, and it's probably one of the few days of the season you do, outside of maybe the start of a playoffs where you have some butterflies and it's just kind of the unknown. You have usually a team that's not the same as it was the year before. There are always some tweaks to every team. I would say maybe not an anxiety, but there's an anticipation. You want to get out there and you want to get started and have a good pregame. And then once the game would start, the jitters are gone and you play baseball. But it's just a great feeling. Opening day is a special feeling, unlike any other sport. And we're excited to get this thing kicked off tonight.
Yeah, and Jared Weaver will get the pearl, and off you go. Congratulations on all the success that the three straight division titles. A lot of folks anxious to see how you guys progress with the new guys, and we'll be keeping an eye on you. Hopefully we can catch up with you down the road, Mike.
All right, guys. Great talking to you. We'll see you sometime out here.
Donating our time to improve your sports knowledge.
What? Yeah, BFF. Give me some of that. Man, that was not really...
Yeah. Can we do that over?
It's too late.
You're listening to the Scott Van Pelt Show on ESPN Radio and ESPNradio.com.